this is a cool party, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Solid. Right on.
Welcome to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. How you doing, Connor?
Doing all right, Earl.
You doing all right?
Yep.
That's good to hear, man. That's good to hear. You know, I got a lot to talk about, and we have a lot to talk about today. Let that play, man. Let that play. Because, you know, and I want to begin, man, as we await the arrival of my co-host Sandy Williams, who will be here shortly. Marvin Gaye, he's been gone a long time.
Yeah, since I think 84.
Okay, so since 1984.
Yeah.
And as iconic of a person as he was, it's amazing that with all of the different movies they've made about the lives of entertainers, his is yet to be made. And I've been waiting for a long time. Marvin Gaye was one of my favorite all-time entertainers. And I've been waiting, wondering when they're going to put a movie together about his life. And finally, you know, after all of this time, next year will begin an epic saga of the life and times of Marvin Gaye. I'm one who will be glued to the screen. They're going to use his actual music, him actually singing in this movie, and I can't wait, man, to get to hear and see it and see who's going to play him. You know, they initially was thought about, what is the guy's name, man? He was married to okay, they've got a daughter named Zoe.
With Saldana, the actress?
No, not Zoe Saldana. It's the guy he plays. Why am I doing this on Monday morning trying to figure this stuff out?
Just give me like one clue and I can look it up right now.
Okay, he's a rock and roll star.
Okay.
He was married to the young lady who used to play on the Cosbys. And they've got a daughter who is a star. So, anyway, that will appear.
Oh, my God, Lisa Bonet.
Lisa Bonet.
Oh, and she was married to Lenny Kravitz. I love Lenny Kravitz.
Yeah, Lenny Kravitz.
Zoe Kravitz. That's the actress. That's his daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was close, right?
Yeah, you were close.
Yeah, I was, at least for those of you who say, what is that old man talking about? At least I knew.
Yeah, I know Lisa. I mean, I used to watch the Cosby Show.
You know, but my point is, Lenny Kravitz would have been the right kind of guy to play Marvin Gaye. But they've gotten to the point now where I guess they've waited so long, it's not going to be him. But I'm interested in finding out. I thought Jamie Foxx might be a guy, but that is going to be a heck of a story. Mm-hmm. You know, for those who don't know, Marvin Gaye, a day or so short of his 45th birthday, was murdered by his father.
Yeah.
You know, he lived with his father and his mother. And as wealthy as he was so strung out on crack, on freebasing cocaine that he was going through a lot of psychological things. When you got all that money and you get high, and you, there's nothing to prevent you or stop you, and you've got enough money to kill yourself. That's basically what he did. He had got so psychologically strung out on freebase and cocaine, man. He would sit in a corner with his back to the corner and a gun in his hand, expecting people to come in and get him. So, you know, and so when he would perform and move to different places, that would be what he would do because of the psychological damage that smoking cocaine had on him long term. And so tragic ending to a very tragic but as talented a person that has ever been in the music industry.
Yeah. It's just so, it's sad, like this, it's like a constant story with a lot of...
Yeah. Well, you know, man, you know
a lot of celebrities.
There are people who believe that if I just had enough money, if I had all this money, my life would be all right. And, you know, money is not always the answer to life. It certainly helps. You know, I'll never know whether or not that that's true or not.
What are you saying, Earl? You have, like, tons of money.
And I'm fine with that, that I'm never going to know what it's like to have more money than I'll ever need. But I'm okay with that, man. You know, life, my life has been, never been around that, you know, and I've always had to live my life, you know, as an average person, you know, not having wealth. And I'm okay with that, man. I'm going to die without having wealth, and that's okay. But when your whole life is centered around wealth, and you know, and you got to do it the way entertainers have to do it, traveling all over the country, all over the world, and everybody's focused, and you got to take care of everybody else.
Constant.
That's a lot of stress.
It's a lot of pressure on one person, especially just because they're doing something like making music, which is something that a lot of people can do. You know, it's not something. I'm not like, of course, Marvin Gaye is incredibly unique as an artist, very unique. But at the same time, it's like all this attention, all this pressure onto you for what reason, you know, and then you look into the system and it's designed to exploit you as much as possible. That's why they have artists travel as much as they do and have that grueling life.
Well, you're
trying to make as much money as possible.
Well, you think back, here's a guy who was kind of like a counterpart to him, decades later, Prince, you know, who kind of walked in his shoes, so to speak, and wound up dealing with, you know, he had that slave kind of thing.
Yeah, on his face in the 90s.
Yeah, because he was tired of, you know, the pressure. Mm-hmm. He just wanted to make music. Mm-hmm. But music is a business. And so he had to go through those kind of struggles. But I look forward to whatever it is they're going to produce. That's going to have Marvin Gaye, the epic life and times of Marvin Gaye. Can't wait to see that. Really excited about it. It's finally going to come to fruition in 2023. And he died, like you say, he died in 1984. And it took this long for them to finally get a chance to put that saga together. Anyway, I wanted to talk a little bit, man, about marijuana. And marijuana use hits record high in the new Gallup poll. Now, this is still amazing to me. 16% of Americans in a new Gallup poll reported smoking marijuana. That's up from 12% last year. So what happened in 1 year that 4% more of the American people have decided to smoke marijuana?
Honesty.
Hi, Sandy.
Good morning.
It's a late arrival, but I can answer why that poll changed.
Good morning to you, my friend. It's Monday. It's Mondays with Sandy Williams, who's made it into the studio and unceremoniously responded to why so many people now are admitting that they smoke marijuana. Well, you know, I remember back when Bill Clinton said he smoked it, but he didn't inhale. And it was a big issue, you know.
He said that. I forgot.
Yeah, it was a big issue. But we are now at a time where in this society.
So he had a problem with training. He just wasn't trained.
But when you look at this is an amazing statistic to me. At the peak of people smoking cigarettes in this country, what percentage of the American people do you think at the height of cigarette smoking smoked cigarettes in this country? Sandy, what percentage of the American?
I bet it was 50.
48%.
Wow.
48% of Americans smoked cigarettes. And you know a lot of that. Did you ever smoke cigarettes?
I tried it. It was sort of a social thing, too.
Right.
You'd kind of to look cool.
Yeah. Were you young when you tried it?
Yeah, I was more in the sort of early adult years. But, you know, everybody smoked. When I went into business, you know, first started in the business world, business flights, airplanes were blue with cigarette smoke because not only could you smoke on airplanes, but when they served you a meal on an airplane, up in the corner of the tray was a little four-pack of Kent cigarettes that were given to you gratuitously so you could light up. The first time I tried a cigarette was flying back to college out to Boston, and there they gave me the cigarettes. Everyone was smoking on the plane. I guess I ought to do this.
Sandy, Kent cigarettes. Listen, you certainly have aged yourself. Kent cigarettes? You know,
Kent. Oh, yeah, well, that was the brand.
I know. I mean, listen, back then, there was Lucky Strike, there was Kent, there was Camels.
LSMFT. Lucky Strike means fine tobacco.
Yeah, and they didn't have filters.
Right, Camels didn't. Kent's did.
Lucky Strike didn't have filters.
Pall Malls. Camels and Lucky Strikes.
Yeah. Right, and what was the, you know, man, we're aging ourselves. But the amazing thing, 48% of Americans smoke cigarettes. Now, you think back to those times. I smoked for a little while. And it
some,
was the
some
same.
Some people say you're still smoking.
Should I distinguish whether it was cigarettes or marijuana?
Yeah, well.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, I think you should, Earl.
Smoking. I was talking like a. Never mind. I was trying to be hip.
Yeah, fit. I mean, I didn't even have it. So.
No, I smoked cigarettes for, I don't know, maybe 6 years. And I did it for the same reasons, Sandy, that you said it was cool.
It was cool, yeah.
Even athletes, even on the football field, man, Lynn Dawson, who used to play for the Kansas City Chiefs, during the games.
Well, you know, I was told by Lowell McDonald, who was the hockey coach at university school, that when he played in the NHL during the Stanley Cups, it was all about winning, and rules were dropped. And he said, guys, hockey players, such an aerobic anaerobic sport, hockey players during the games would go down in the little in the pathway from the locker room, and they'd smoke during the games.
That is just amazing. They've got this iconic picture of Lynn Dawson, one of my favorite quarterbacks, Kansas City Chiefs, of all times, sitting on the bench while the game is going on. Smoking a cigarette.
Wow.
And so it's so amazing that was a part of our culture. And so, you know, everybody did it.
In the golf, professional golf range, smoking cigarettes was done during play. In fact, Arnold Palmer's part of his ritual was to take the cigarette out of his mouth, lay it down on the ground, take a practice swing, and hit the golf ball. It was on television.
You know, you used to watch the people smoke the cigarettes and throw them on the floor and put them out on the floor. and all over the place, right? I mean, that's the culture that we had. Got to go to a break. Phone lines are open as always at 844-967-2789. It's Monday. That's Mondays with my co-host, Sandy Williams. You can join us. We'll be right back. At 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams, my co-host. And Sandy, I want to get back a little bit to, you know, what's happening with marijuana and the legalization of marijuana. I think when they say 16% have admitted, I believe there's 35% or more of the American people, maybe even 40%, that smoke marijuana.
I mean, I can't, honestly, with my personal experience, I can't tell you, but I'm confident that
it's more than 16%.
Whatever is reported in surveys, it's more than that because, first of all, there's a number of states where it isn't legal, where it's clearly smoked quite commonly.
Right.
I mean, it's smoked quite commonly in Wisconsin. People get in their car and go to Chicago, get the stuff, come back. I know that because I walk on the streets, I smell it. It's, in fact, it seems to be almost as common here as it is in a state where it's legal. So I just think Wisconsin's such a goofy place with this puritanical political standard that they try to impose on the state, irregardless of how the people actually think or live, that here we have it, it's illegal, the state gets no revenue from it, people drive down to Chicago.
Minnesota,
these states are deriving substantial revenue from it, and I don't think the rate of marijuana smoking is materially higher in those states than it is here.
You know, Sandy, it really is kind of nuts that we live in a country that it's still illegal and people can be arrested for it.
Right, somehow the fact that you smoke it makes it different than you drink it. I mean,
I know.
My dad lived through Prohibition, and we all shake our head at Prohibitions. What a goofy thing. The United States tried to ban alcohol, and people went to jail for selling and alcohol, and people used to get arrested and get tickets and spend the night in jail for drinking alcohol. I mean, we shake our head. That's crazy. Well, what the hell? Wait, what's going on here? Because, you know, we've got something, marijuana, which apparently doesn't seem to have an effect it might be different than alcohol. It might have detrimental effects that are different than alcohol. But alcohol has plenty of detrimental effects. I know that from family experience.
I think we all know it from family experience. And what I would say to you, Sandy, is when you hear the response that, okay, we know alcohol has all these detrimental, problems with it, but it's legal.
Yeah.
Okay, so, but marijuana is illegal, so we don't want to add another. I mean, if that's the best argument you can come up with, Sandy, that's an argument that has long since lost its validity, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, misogyny used to be illegal.
Used to be legal.
Legal. Or, yeah. I don't know, illegal.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what
oh yeah,
is.
Right.
Or whatever.
Illegal,
no,
right.
I used the wrong term, actually. I was thinking of mixed racial marriage.
Right.
Which they maybe used to call
misogyny. Yeah, it used to be illegal, right.
Yeah, it used to be illegal.
Yeah.
So, but we're at a point, Sandy, where in this society, in this country, we gotta get beyond those kind of things. But When you look at how many people died from smoking cigarettes.
Well, to be honest with you, this is just to take something from a specific subject to a general. I think the whole way we deal with marijuana is part of this kind of hypocritical approach to the laws, that you know, what we talk about and what we do. Banning abortion, and yet we know that numbers of families and people... Numbers of people who are supporting banning abortion will undoubtedly come to an experience in their family in which they will find a way to have an abortion for someone in their family because of an unwanted pregnancy. You know, it's hypocrisy. And everyone knew that the banning of alcohol, the way it was playing out during Prohibition, was hypocrisy, that everyone was drinking, and yet it was illegal. And now we've got the same thing going with marijuana in a state like Wisconsin, where we've got this sort of duality involved in our politics, where we say one thing and everyone understands that the reality is different.
You know, Sandy, I don't know if the business community does drug tests as much as they used to. I don't know if it's changed with the legalization.
Well, the goofy
of marijuana.
Well, the goofy thing is that my understanding of drug testing is that marijuana resides in your system residually for a long time.
Right.
See, the only thing they can effectively test you for with respect to drugs is marijuana, because you know,
right,
you can stop doing addictive narcotic drugs, and within days or hours,
out of
your system, and you don't test positively for it. So the only thing you can test positively for is this socially benign thing, marijuana. And I'm confident that the NFL has stopped testing for it.
Yeah, I know the NFL, the NBA, those kind of things. But I'm saying, not so long ago, if you went to apply for a job,
yeah,
they would drug test you for marijuana. And if you had marijuana in your system, I don't care how bright you were or what your credentials were, you were banned basically from getting the job.
Yeah, well, I'm confident that businesses have rolled that back. I think there still are some that do it. One of the fellows that I had breakfast with relatively regularly, a younger fellow, was applying for a job, and he was talking about how he was having to abstain for like a month or 3 weeks,
right,
to make sure he could pass his test.
Well, so you would think, Sandy, that with the shortage of workers today,
yeah,
and all those kinds of things, and marijuana being what it is, that, like you said, the businesses will get smart. You think they probably have backed up on those things?
Well, they're rolling back on credentials. I think a couple of weeks ago on a show, we found out that teaching in some state, they've rolled back the college degree requirement.
Right. Military guys.
They're rolling back requirements on all kinds of things. So I suspect that'd be an early one to roll back the requirement for.
All right, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. It's Mondays. Mondays with my co-host Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. The Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with my co-host Sandy Williams. And Sandy, you and I have been talking about this a little bit, touching around the edges of it for a while about what took place in Washington, D.C. January 6th. 2 years ago, and the FBI and our government is still investigating what really appeared to be an overthrow of our government, an attempted overthrow of our government. And even though people, the conservatives, said, well, that was blown out of proportion, it really wasn't that. And, you know, it was a handful of maybe 200 people who acted in that manner. Anybody who could whose vision wasn't impaired could see what that was and the possibilities of what that could have wound up becoming. And now you've got Lindsey Graham, the United States Senator, warning of riots in the streets if Trump is charged over classified docs. Now, let me first begin by, Trump is not the president anymore. He's a citizen, right? He's a citizen.
Well, he's a citizen even when he's president.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, he's a citizen even when he's president.
That's one of the people talked about how the American political system was remarkable because we have citizen presidents.
But he doesn't have the power of the presidency anymore. And so he's not the president anymore of our country, and he's a citizen. Well, you said it before, so is Biden. But Biden still has the power of being the president of the United States. And so Donald Trump has done some nefarious things. That's who he is. He's always done those kinds of things, Sandy. But how is it that United States senator and other United States congressmen and women have joined on the bandwagon, hands off of Donald Trump?
Well, here's what's concerning, I think, about Lindsey Graham and what he's saying now is that he's sort of blowing the dog whistle to the American public that is the group that is strongly behind Donald Trump, essentially the Trumpsters.
The MAGAs.
Well, but these are, and I don't
not just MAGAs.
I'm not dehumanizing these people. Right. These are human beings. These are like Lou from Cudahy, who called in, who feel very strongly about this. It's like the guy that sat next to me on the airplane and he said he loved Donald Trump. I said, why? He said, because Donald Trump's an American and I love America. And Lou, who told us that liberals were not patriots, that liberals were trying to tear apart the fabric of America, they should never be in power, essentially, because we were dangerous in that regard if we were liberals. So there's a whole group, a cadre of people who think that government is illegitimate if it's being run by, for instance, liberals, that the fabric of America is at risk here. And these are the same people who are saying that there's a leftist police state. Lou told us that on the radio, that there's a leftist police state ready to take power in America. And many of those people think that this investigation of Donald Trump is just a demonstration of the leftist police state taking hold of America and now trying to bring down the ex-president of the United States, who's the leader of this MAGA movement, trying to bring him down through a police action. And so then now we've got Lindsey Graham, who instead of standing up responsibly like a U.S. responsible U.S. senator would and say, let's let this investigation run its course. Let's find out whether and what was done illegally, and let's stand behind the enforcement of laws to the extent that we find out that there was a material violation of an important law as the result of this investigation. But no, Lindsey Graham stands up before all that is in and simply puts his finger up, tests the political wind, and says, basically, if you guys keep chasing after Donald Trump, you're going to have hell to pay. You know, they're going to get you. Well, the they who are going to get you, essentially, are a bunch of weapon-bearing, unhappy people in America who now think that America is being torn asunder by a leftist police state, and there needs to be a revolution, a civil war. I mean, literally, he's beating the drum with a dog whistle for a civil war. People who should stand up against the government. How do you stand up against the government? You should stand up against the enforcement of the principles and laws of government. Stand up, fight the rule of law as it might be imposed by a government. I mean, it's actually craziness, and it's calling for the kind of violence and violent outcome that people worry about, shake their head about. And I'm telling you that if this kind of talk continues, it's going to happen.
You know, Sandy, I have to say to you that those people who feel that way and who are willing to carry that out, I can't look at them any other way as people who are going to become criminals, because you can't say to me that these are just ordinary, normal citizens and people who didn't get it their way, and they're going to respond by overthrowing our government, and that they shouldn't be seen in a different light. They should be seen in the light of people who are willing to do that, irregardless of what they feel, because their feelings are no different than other American citizens who have not had things their way.
Well, but we've championed revolutionaries. The American Revolution is a champion thing. These were people who wanted their freedom from the country that they were that they were in, right? We were Englishmen until we weren't, until we rose up and fought against them. So history looks backwards, and some revolutions and some people who want to take up their arms against the government are idealized, and some of them are viewed as criminals. And so the people, I just think we need to be careful. We've got 20 million people with AR-15s. All of them can't be bad people, right? We don't have that many.
Well said.
And we've got 65 million people who, and I don't know how many of them are actually strident MAGAs, not that many, but we're 75 million. And that voted for Donald Trump. If half of those people are strident MAGA people, we can't just assume that they aren't good people and that they're just
so
misguided they're frightened people. They're misguided and frightened.
But if they are going to respond to what happens to one man,
right?
I could understand there's things going on in the government that they don't support. For instance, again, the fact that we continue to become and spend the resources that we have on the military. The fact that we won't do the things that we need to do to support the American people, but are willing to do other things. I'm with them on that. Those, to me, are laudable reasons to challenge our government. But to challenge the government based on the fact that you can't do or say anything to one man,
yeah,
is where I draw the line.
Well, I think what I'm talking about is the manifestation of the fragility of the American democracy. And the American democracy requires responsible leadership. It requires responsible leadership that believes in the norms of the values that are the underlying values and norms for a democratic government, which include abiding by the law, the rule, abiding by the rule of law, applying it all to everyone, and having a responsible exchange of power. You know, when Al Gore talked about that and how he behaved with respect to it, I've got to say now that he had a much more sophisticated understanding of why we have this orderly transfer of power and why it is so fundamental in American politics, because we're now seeing what happens when you don't have it. When you don't have it, then you've got all of this hue and outcry about what happened to the guy who just left power, who claims that he was cheated out of his office, who claims now that he's being the victim of a police state because he's being investigated for his malfeasance or potential malfeasance. I mean, we have a system that requires people to be civil to one another and civilized, that requires that we abide by the norms of the social norms that are necessary to have this. And we've had this 20 years of political activity with no leadership. People who are in leadership are basically divisive. Barack Obama is the last person we've had in power who didn't try to be divisive.
But Sandy, these people aren't going to abide by the rule of law. These people clearly are going to take the matters into their own hands.
Well, but when we say these people, that sounds like deplorables. I'm not willing to go there, because I think when we talk about a large number of people, we have to be like historians and try and delve into why it is that a large number of people feel this way, and we need to begin to deal with that. I'm not legitimizing their feelings. I'm just saying we can't us and them
but,
away.
But see, you can't on the one hand say, Sandy, they can't on the one hand say that anybody who says defund the police and Black Lives Matter and those protesters, many of these people we're talking about are the same people who decried what took place in Kenosha and Racine and other places across this nation with people of color when they fought about innocent people being slaughtered by police.
Right.
And many of these very same people spoke in opposition to that. Well, and demeaned the people who stood for what they believed was righteous.
Here's the screwiness of this. The people, the Black Lives Matter movement, were basically people who were uprising against the way government was being implemented against them, and it was a reflection of their fears of what this government meant for the safety and sanctity of the lives of these people on whom unfair government was being inflicted. All these people out there who are now talking about uprising are people who are afraid of the government and afraid of the way the government will affect the way their lives go, except that they're looking at it from something, a different kind of a vantage point. They're saying, we want life to be like it was. We want it to be like Ozzie and Harriet on TV. We want to feel that same sort of comfort level. We don't want the discomfort of having our jobs in a fragile state in a globalized world. We don't want to have new religions and new cultures introduced into our society. That's what Lou from Cudahy said. They're going to do these 4 million illegal Mexican immigrants are going to be bearing arms against the country and tearing at the American society and destroying it. Now, that's a very fearful image. It's paranoid in my mind. It's racist, possibly, in its basis, but it exists, and I believe it's much more pervasive than we're willing to admit.
So where does that group of people, what makes them any more Americans and their beliefs any more different than any other Americans?
Well, it doesn't.
Because all of us supposedly have equal footage in this nation. And so as Americans, none of those things that they're feeling, that's all right for that group that feels that way. But there's another whole group of Americans who see that as something that is not American and does not include. So they're concerned about the changes that they see happening in this nation. Well, there's another group of Americans who aren't the majority who see this thing, and we say, hey, wait a minute.
Well, but fear is our most powerful human beings.
Right.
Fear is our most powerful emotion. It's also the one that's easiest to evoke. All you have to do is do something fearful to get this fear operating. And what we're talking about now is people who are motivated by fear and
that are heavily armed.
And this is the way I get around to the question of leadership. Our leadership is what's necessary to coax people. First of all, our leadership are the people who have been creating the fear in many respects. I mean, there is fear resident in all of us.
Right.
And when our jobs are being taken away from us, we become fearful about our future. And now we can begin to play with that fear if we're a leader. And we can take that fear for positive or negative means. And political leadership has seized upon it for political
Sandy, we got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. Join us. Sandy Williams, Earl Ingram. Be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And we're talking about Lindsey Graham. He warned the government. Sandy, a United States sitting United States senator, warned the United States government of riots in the street, armed riots. He's warning that this is coming.
Well, I mean,
if something happens to their leader, who is not the president of the United States.
Well, I mean, talking like that is what people call a dog whistle. So he's warning about it. He's predicting it. Okay, he's essentially sanctifying it by talking in that manner instead of saying what we've got to do, people, is someone who's a leader can talk in a responsible manner about having the people stand by. Let's let the government work its process. Let's see what's happening here. But he's predicting a dire outcome, which of course gives greater credence to the possibility that it will happen. I mean, I think the problem we've got, and so I like I say, without legitimizing all these negative fears, I think we have to understand them and give credence to the people who have them, because there are so many people who have these views who are thinking like Lou from Cudahy, and it's not that there's nothing wrong with those people other than the fact that they're misguided, you know, that their fear has taken a hold of their thought process in a manner that has tilted their process. And if we respond to it by tilting it further, if we respond and talk like the leftist police state that they're warning us about, if we talk about a heavier imposition of the enforcement of law instead of talking more generally about the principle of government, about the importance of letting things work, of equality, we've had 20 years with essentially no political leadership. Barack Obama was a political head charisma and was a leader, but because he was black, he was divisive, right?
Right.
So it was like an unfair, he carried a color on his skin that made him divisive, even though he was a charismatic guy. We had Dwight Eisenhower after World War II, who brought with him the charisma of a five-star general and coming out of World War II, followed immediately by JFK, who was a very young, charismatic guy in the beginning of TV coverage of politics. And here was a TV star, essentially, who had great charisma. And ever since JFK, we've had this sort of emptiness in terms of leadership. It became very clear during the Nixon years when the country fell apart over Vietnam because we had no leadership with respect to how people could stand back and look at it, and we had a government that was misleading us, right? And so the Vietnam experience gave everyone our age the cynicism to look at government and say that it might be doing bad things to us, which is what in some respects is driving this whole militia movement that is fearful of the police state that's going to be imposed on them by the people they disagree with, the liberals, who are going to bring into this country a bunch of people who aren't in their minds Americans, who are going to tear apart the fabric of American culture, which is driven in many respects by a fear of race and difference,
so Sandy,
and tribalism. Race and tribalism are only going to be defeated. Racism and tribalism are only by leadership.
So we
need leaders.
So as a black American who lived through the civil rights struggle, who knows the history of the nation and what took place and what is presently taking place, we're supposed to somehow understand, you know, people who are fearful that they're going to lose the things that they had, and they'll respond to that in a violent nature, and yet people, blacks in this nation, who saw all of this degradation and injustice and anti-Americanism that happened to them and continues to happen to them. You know, and yet we're supposed to somehow feel the pain and the ire of people who are armed, who are willing to overthrow the government because things aren't going their way.
That's it. The whole problem in American culture is we do have this deep-seated problem of race. And so, you know, I saw a Saturday Night Live routine that was just perfect to epitomize it, because, you know, we've got this debate about AR-15s, okay,
right,
and the ownership of AR-15s. And so this skit involved several black guys showing up at Congress with their AR-15, saying, "Absolutely,
we know what the outcome of that would be.
We want to own AR-15s," and it's and they're saying all the same words that the people supporting it,
right.
And everyone was in horror. You know, in the audience was like, "Oh my God, we got to ban AR-15s. Look what's going to happen." So yeah, I mean, that's the, we have a basic problem, and you know, everyone who wants to be deniers of it, this whole 1619, the rebellion over critical race theory and everything is all about essentially denial of the of a fundamental problem we've got, which is sauce for the goose is not sauce for the
gander. So, Sandy, this is why the nation is in a perilous time.
Yes.
And whether people listening to us don't want to believe that or not, doesn't mean it's not there. And it doesn't mean that our nation can't be there because of all of our military might, and all of those things don't even come into play when we're talking about internally the dangers.
Well, we had discussed after January 6th the concept of how much of the military, where would the military have gone if they had competing orders from a Biden and a Trump? And there was definitely some view that there would be some in the military who would
have went with Trump,
go the Trump direction, and some would go the Biden direction. But we also have 20 million AR-15s in private hands. If they are primarily in the hands of people who are interested in essentially defending themselves against this left-wing government that they're afraid of, we don't have enough military to deal with that.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct, and that's the inherent danger that the nation faces. If we don't take this seriously, and there are people who, Sandy, aren't taking it seriously, but you can rest assured there are others.
Well, Lindsey Graham isn't taking it seriously because he's pouring some gasoline on the flames.
And that should be without question. It's one of the reasons why we're talking about it so intensely this morning. Our phone lines are open at 844-967-2789. It's Monday. It's Mondays with Sandy Williams. What do you say? We'll be right back.